Hello, I'm at the University of South Florida, and my colleague Manisha Joshi is here with me, and I'll just jump right in there. See, put my glasses on. I have no conflicts to disclose, and that's what the slide's all about. And my study has to do with resilience among Haitians in the aftermath of the earthquake. If you're here, you already know a great deal of resilience literature. With the American Heritage Dictionary, pretty much refers to the ability to, if you're referring to metal, the ability to return to your original shape after being stretched, compressed, and so on. And referring to persons, it's really putting it to the ability to recover readily from illness and associated traumas. Naturally, the 2010 earthquake was a traumatic event, not just for those residing in Haiti, but for those in the diaspora who are members of the Haitian community and for many other sympathizers and people who ally with the community. And following the earthquake, I kept reading about how very resilient Haitians were, and I myself was not feeling very resilient at all. I was having a very hard time feeling isolated from my community, both here, because I was teaching at Arkansas State University, and resilience was not probably even the most close on my mind. I was just feeling really crushed and unable to help and isolated. So I wanted to look into what that meant. We received a grant from the National Science Foundation to travel to Haiti and look at social capital, which we'll discuss in a little bit. But as I mentioned before, resilience is often associated with traumatogenic events. And Haitians have, of course, been subjected to historical, you know, social and cumulative trauma. And so I thought it was particularly important to look at resilience among Haitians. Okay. Luther and colleagues makes a distinction between resilience and resiliency. You can read this for yourself. And Mastin suggests that resilience can be developed. And that's particularly important because in the aftermath of the earthquake, I watched a young man following his mother, who apparently had been a wealthy woman because you could still see some jewelry on her. But this was 3 months after the earthquake, and she was still walking around dusty, covered with dust, and her hair was disheveled. And a little boy was following her barefooted down the street, just looking at her back and with this look of utter panic on his face. And I thought 3 months after the earthquake, this woman was talking to herself and gesticulating wildly and talking to automobiles and so on. And I thought, wow, where is this resilience? It's not everyone that's going to be resilient. It's not a nation. And yet I kept hearing people talking about a resilient nation. These are traits of resilient persons that you'll see in the literature that we reviewed. So our aim was to really try to understand if resilience, as it's currently defined in the literature, can it be used to explain the experiences and possibly the prognoses of Haitians and their members of their social networks. So we summarized the literature on resilience and tried to apply that knowledge to understanding the experiences of the people. So our first study, because social capital is such an important aspect of resilience, particularly with respect to one's social network and its ability to provide support, we had gone out to Haiti to study social capital in relation to post-earthquake housing recovery. And so we asked people, what was your neighborhood like before the earthquake? What was your family like before the earthquake? And how are things now? And how are you able to cope? And what's different? And it's clear what we used to do the analysis. But we targeted members of three different communities. And we did so because we wanted to look at socioeconomic status as, you know, in relation to social capital to see if there was any major difference across the three communities. And of course, we did interviews, as you can see, focus groups, and then returned for town hall meetings across the three communities to ensure that what they had actually told us, what we documented, was in fact what we would be reporting. Okay, for the literature review, this just summarizes what type of literature that we looked at, and we included books if the author of the book was considered an expert on resilience, on Haitians, or on a combination of those with trauma. As you can see from this, I wish I could, I don't know if you can see that. Oops, okay, that was bad. Sorry. I won't touch that again. But the stuff in red, the lettering in red, shows you there's very little literature specific to Haitians and resilience that we're able to find in these three different databases, and even less on resilience, trauma, and Haitians. Okay, I'm not sure how much you can see this, but this is a summary of the major findings on resilience in general that we selected as a final sample of what we would use as a framework to apply to the people from the social capital study. Several things stick out that are going to show up in their own words, and that has to do with the spiritual stance, hope, discipline, and low tolerance for unacceptable behavior in others, ability to return to previous levels of functioning, and so on. And Gerda Nicholas, who's a Haitian psychologist, I'm sure has presented here before, wrote a lot about cultural factors such as proverbs in relation to resilience among Haitians. Okay. And so with respect to, let's put the glasses on here, to the articles that spoke specifically to Haitians and resilience, there were several, but only three actually added to knowledge. The other ones were just kind of like, oh, we also interviewed Haitians as a subsample of a Caribbean population, which is a subsample of an African-American population, and they really shed no new knowledge. But those that I did discuss mental health and how metaphors were used to describe Haitians as flexible and bending but not breaking like bamboo, but we'll show you some specific quotes from the people themselves. With respect to Flack's conceptualization of resilience as discipline and low tolerance, you can see that this gentleman expressed a great deal of bitterness and anxiety and frustration that we were considered the pearl of the Antilles as a nation, and now people can't even find food to eat, and he was calling for resolution. Now, it showed discipline in that he was restrained and hadn't caused any problems, but he was showing very low tolerance for this unacceptable behavior of not caring for its people with respect to the government. Spirituality of faith, there was so much reference to faith, and I think you've seen the on the news, the pictures of people praying, falling on their faces, and there was a lot of reference to, well, we didn't die, so somehow God must have a plan for us. You know, this whole thing involved us being chastised. It was a punishment, perhaps, but there is we have something that is durable, and that is lasting, and that is our faith. Okay. And then there was a major dispute in the town hall meetings across the three communities with respect to people's authenticity or the authenticity of their faith, that perhaps what they were referring to as faith was not so much faith, but something that they would grasp in times of despair and panic. So there was a debate among those who were saying, God helped me, and those who said, I will survive because of the strength of my biceps. I will cause things to happen for myself. Okay. This one was particularly important because Warner and Smith mentioned new friendships as a component of resilience, but this one I'm going to read out loud because everybody from across the three communities said, in the immediate aftermath of the earthquake, both rich and poor, light-skinned and dark men and women drank from the same cup. They mentioned we carried them on our backs. They promised us jobs afterwards. These were the poorer people. And now things are just the way they used to be. So those friendships that occurred in the immediate aftermath did not endure after the initial aftershocks. And then everybody continued, this is an illustrative quote, of people just expressing frustration. They'd say, I'm bouquet, just to the point of weariness, and how they explained over the decades, you know, this gentleman who was 49 years old had seen no change, even though he'd believed in a whole bunch of promises, and said, we are absolutely bouquet, and if we protest, we're just going to be beaten. So it seems to be a sense of resignation to how things are. And then yet another one mentioned feeling that we have made several requests for help already. We've seen, you know, Chile had an earthquake within a year and a half that I've conducted this research, and we've seen changes for them. But here it says there is no leadership. It's as if we're in a wilderness or a wasteland and just a team of goats roaming about without a shepherd or a goat herd. Okay, with respect to Luther's return to previous level of functioning, this female community leader from Pétionville was very happy in seeing just the women who sold peanuts and canapé, which is a fruit, going back to what they used to do. And to her, that was indicative of coping and resilience. And yet this community leader said, well, maybe we're just not valuable because although we believe and there is hope and we can accept suffering, but it's not sweet. You know, we just find ourselves that we just have to accept this. We don't have any option of doing anything to the contrary. So we conclude we're not valuable. So this was a sense of, again, resignation and hopelessness. And then as idioms of distress, this woman complained that I feel as if I'm speaking in the void. Nothing will ever be resolved. No one ever comes to help. I feel that the next one said there's something running through my head. I'm close to simply taking off and running, like I want to escape, just to not be here anymore. Sense of frustration, but helplessness more than hopefulness. Again, another person, existing in a void, living in mud, women putting their babies in dressers, young children now lost with losing parents and everything, and young men being heads of themselves, causing problems, engaging in sexual violence, and then now for women, special challenges of HIV because of loss of family members and sponsors and rape. Okay. With respect to cultural factors and wisdom, Lindley and Nicholas's assertions regarding resilience, I love this one because it seems like women would say, when I first lost my children, I turned to look to see where everybody would be to comfort me. This is how we did. We comforted each other in community, in concert. And she said, there was no one to comfort. And so I find myself just looking around, everybody else screaming. So now we've become desensitized to death. We've lost our sense of ritual. And now each firefly lights its own way. There's no more community. There's more an individualistic every man for himself thing. Trying to get through quickly. There's only one person across all of these people who found something positive about, before the earthquake, I used to be afraid of blood, but I find myself lifting people from under the debris who are covered in blood. I will never be afraid again. Nothing worse could happen than what I've seen and experienced. So I was no longer afraid of blood. So the conclusion is that resilience as it's defined, it's wonderful. We've got a whole lot of information, but it doesn't seem sufficient when it comes to trying to explain what has happened in this event. And it's transferable, definitely, many of the concepts, but not sufficient. And I know Dr. Congress writes a lot about ethics and resilience. It's just not responsible, I think, to just define Haitians as a whole group as resilient without doing more research, without having a clear definition of what it means in that context. So I think future studies, we do need a lot more studies to do much larger studies, to look at maybe a nationwide study of, you know, what it means. Because we just wrote an article about social capital and how it's defined in Haiti and sexual violence and that contextual definition. I think maybe also resilience, because if we don't take the time to look at that, the fact that we think they're resilient without knowing what we mean by that may mean that we fail to provide certain services that might be needed, even to the point of getting from them, you know, what is it that you need? 1 minute, and guess what? I think I'm done. Future studies should look at what resilience means to Haitians across developmental stages and social classes, maybe gender differences, and as well as doing comparison studies, looking at resilience factors among those who actually survived it and those, like I, who experienced it vicariously. Muchas gracias.
Out there, because it's been my experience with the community. Now, in terms of your work and through
be interested in collaborating with anyone and also in working with another community.
Reach.
In the aftermath of the earthquake, the churches were no longer just the upper class, you know. Wino Kanape Bears were many of the diplomats lived. President Prevalis lived in Kanape Bear. Are you not hearing me? Okay, sorry.
Just seeing if we can get the cord to you. It's very tangled.
But in Pétionville, after the earthquake, many people whose homes were destroyed in Pétionville, in Port-au-Prince proper, merchants, lower class people flocked to Pétionville, so I was able to capture members of both groups in the interviews and stuff. But yeah, after the earthquake, there was no longer a distinct, this is not the rich community, this is not the middle class, which would have been Pétionville in this case, or Delma. And we had lower Delma and higher Delma, so we captured all of them, but again, the samples were quite small, 38, 60, whatever was for the other one.
Kind of a related thing. I wonder if there was a difference afterwards between kind of people who were poor to begin with and people who were richer, just because in the beginning everyone was we were all in the same situation and everyone was trying to help each other. Mm-hmm. But after a while, the people who were richer, even if they were really hurt, kind of came up better.
Thank you. We didn't get to interview, that was a limitation. Members of the elite class, it would have been great to interview President Preval and say, how are you doing this? But what happened is many people who were from the upper or elite classes had traveled out of the country. Mm-hmm. There were people that were complaining that were saying, this guy's got his dog in a special hospital in New York City, and the dog's living better than I am, you know, on his terrain, you know, with frogs jumping in my food. So we didn't get members of the elite, but we did get poorer people and middle class people. We even got people from Cité Soleil, which is the poorest area, that along with Bel Air, the poorest slum in Haiti. But yeah, it would have been nice to hear from the elite what was going on. But obviously, my mom lives in a really nice home, and someone had dug a hole through the wall, through the cement, to drag out mattresses and you know, sheets and things that they needed. So people who were better off were actually running because people were so desperate, as you know, from traveling back and forth.
Other questions?
Well, I was particularly interested also in the presentation about the Village Degree Program. And I'm really interested just in terms of, and I don't know if I was included because we just were approved on it. I don't think I was in your sample, but just in terms of some of the main concerns, the expense of a dual degree program, and there seemed to be not that many resources for. I mean, already, even for a single degree program, you graduate with huge, huge debts, but for a dual degree, and that's an issue of there not being enough financial aid. Challenges in coordinating a public health program and a social work program. And this is something we're really struggling for because we're not even the same institution. We're not even, because our program's with Mount Sinai is a public health school, and we're a Fordham University, so there's lots and lots of challenges. And also, I just wanted to say something in terms of, you know, integration. That's really important, I think, with students just taking courses in the social work school and taking courses in the public health school, but how to never the twain to be, right? And especially if the schools are in different locations. And of course, one challenge is, and this is probably true in terms of your universities too. I mean, you can't run a class if you have like fewer than 10 students. So therefore, if you only have, I mean, I know Boston's is very large, but many public health and social work programs are very small. And I just know what would happen if I went to my dean, you know, like, okay, I want to start a class of public health and social work students, and I said, but I only have 3 students, right? So I think that's one of the challenges.
I mean, I think that the funding goes along with the communication. If there's not communication and support between the two schools or two programs, then funding will be more difficult. You know, we said these schools are expensive on their own, and if you're paying for them separately, even then it's more difficult. And even at BU, we've been in existence over 30 years, and you know, people at school public health might not even know it exists. there aren't so many classes in between, campuses are, you know, miles apart.
That's another issue.
And if there's not even communication and support, then funding won't come.
They're not even that far away, and still we find it hard to do that.
Sure.
And I'm really looking forward to seeing this as a publication, because that will help me.
Yeah.
They're already doing it.
We're working on it.
We were missing one school, and the person who didn't answer came to the reception yesterday. I'm not going to name names. And she volunteered her to participate. And we will have actually all 37 schools with existing programs at this time, but probably we won't pull theirs in only interested.
Too new. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, no, we're really infant stage. We're about a month old. Yeah, right. Right. Yeah.
I wanted to follow up on that line of questioning. In any of the qualitative responses, was there any mention of kind of serving both masters between CSWE and CEEF, and, you know, this whole, the issue of, so I manage the dual degree program at the University of Kent, and our students are torn, the elective issue, right? But our hands are tied. I have to meet CEEF's requirements, and I have to meet CSWE's requirements. And did that come up at all in any of the qualitative responses? Or if you maybe have suggestions on recommendations for those two accrediting bodies.
Yeah, I don't think that's the physical.
We didn't ask about it because, well, for a variety of reasons, not all the programs are structured differently. And so we asked very broad questions about flexibility. And so we didn't get into the specifics. Not every school supports the use of the CEEF exam.
Mm-hmm.
Not every school interprets the Council of Social Work Education program EPAS standards exactly the same way. So we might have one semester of human behavior that we require, and then we might waive it if somebody's taking a course over at the School of Public Health that is behaviorally oriented. So we really ask very broad questions and let people park themselves within our data.
I think it might be an interesting place for some future work for the Public Health and Social Work Caucus to kind of tease out a little more where the schools are landing with flexibility with those two different bodies.